accession number 21110, reel 3.
Jerry Locke, reel 3. So who was it that wrote letters complaining about the accommodation, do you think?
Well, general troops writing home, you know, and when the officers censored it, they could see what was in the letters, like, you know.
So what did you feel about the accommodation you'd had?
Not very good, you know. It's very cold, you know.
So you were sleeping in barns, were you? Or?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But we went into a private house then. There was just a woman and her two sons. Her husband had been carted away by the Germans. We were only there a few days, and we were told that we were moving out the next day, but this time on transporters.
Oh, right.
So next day came, and we loaded up on a transporters. No idea where we were going, and off we went.
And this is B Squadron.
Yes, yeah. Just B Squadron, yeah. Mm-hmm. And off we went. And we got to the Dutch town of Heerlen.
Oh, yeah. How do you spell that?
H-W-E-R-L-E-N, I think it is, yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And here, we joined the 9th American Army.
Right, yeah.
The 2nd Armored Division of the 9th American Army.
Right. So that was a bit of a culture shock, was it?
It was, yeah. We had no idea that, you know.
And who did you, how much did you mix with them?
Well, in the beginning, we didn't do a terrible lot of mixing. It seemed to be that a lot of liaison was going between the officers of the Americans and our own officers.
Right.
They were liaison. And then the Americans gave a party to the children. And we went along, and we were all given the youngster to look after, you know. And
those are the children from the town.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Because they must have had quite a bad time, mustn't
they? Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm.
Did you talk to the local people at all? I mean, you talked to the children. How bad had it been for them?
Oh, it had been terrible. When we were at a place called Zeost, we stopped outside of a house, and they asked us in, and they were really starving, so we got some tins of meat and veg and cooked up for them and put it on the table. And before the mother could get any plates out, the young boys were dipping their hands in, you know, and it was terrible. And funny enough, the young girl in the house there, I still write to her now. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
What was her name?
Van Hoff.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Joe, her Christian name.
How much did you meet them? I mean, you just met them a few times then, did you? Or?
Well, just over a few days before we moved out, like, you know.
So were you eating with the American Army, or were you just you completely self?
No, we had our own cooks, mm-hmm. but American rations.
Oh, right.
Which was quite good.
Were they good?
Oh, yeah. Mm. And each day when we were going into action, we used to have a box, 5 man 1 day, 5 man 2 day, and that was the crew's meal, and that was good, everything in there, you know, butter, and bits of bacon, and cigarettes, even down to toilet paper they used to put in their rations, you know, but peanut butter I couldn't stand, you know. Their biscuits were a lot better than ours, you know, they're more palatable than what our own was. And their tins of stews and things like that was a lot better.
What did you think about the American army? Did you think they were good, efficient, or?
The thing that got me about them, really, I think they had too many men in machines. They used to throw things in. You know, seemed to be if 20 men got killed, another 20 went in, and then five tanks got knocked out. Well, we got another five back there, like, you know. And that was the scene. And I felt that at times, well, the whole squadron did, thought that we were being put into more difficult positions than we should have been put in. So there was a complaint went in from our squadron leader, and then we got withdrawn from the line, and we gave a demonstration of flamethrowers, and on the bank was high-ranking officers of the American forces watching, as our people say, we should be used, like, you know. And
right. So how much had you hadn't used your flamethrowers at all in Europe then yet? This was the first time, was it?
Our flamethrowers, yeah. I don't know about
the tank you
No.
Yeah.
When we moved out from here then, in November, mm-hmm. We moved over to the German border, right. And we believed that we were the first British tanks on the German soil.
Oh, right. Do you know where you crossed?
Yeah, our first attack was at Fleilenhoi.
Can you spell that?
Frail Den Hoven.
Right, okay.
That was our first target.
Right, so tell me about that. What sort of land was it? What sort of terrain? And, you know, what
well, the thing was, it had been pouring rain for a couple of days. And we moved out in the morning, and our objective was this village. We hadn't gone far, and we came to a stop. And gradually, we moved up, and apparently, there was an anti-tank ditch far wider than they anticipated, and they had to get more of the palings to pile in for us to go over. They'd pulled away the tank tracks to make a road through, and then there in front of us was a flail tank, and I think it was from the Lothian borders, just one. They flailed a road through a minefield for us. When we got to the road, the flail swung left, mm-hmm. and we got on the road and swung to the right. We went down into a field of sugar beet, which we were told was a dummy minefield. It was marked Optimum mm-hmm. Mine. It was a dummy minefield. So we went down in, turned right, and we got around about 200 yards, and there was a terrific bang, and the tank came to a shredder in a halt, and there were bits and pieces falling about the turret. And Lieutenant Adams shouted out, "We been hit. Is everybody all right?" And each one of us over the intercom, like, you know, answered back. Sergeant Henderson, that was coming up on our left flank, he came over the radio to say we'd hit a mine, and our left-hand track was shattered, and the bogies was shattered. In front of us, a troop corporal had gone through a hedge, and the hedge had grown over an anti-tank ditch, and he's gone into the anti-tank ditch, couldn't get out. Sergeant And the other captain was, can't remember the other sergeant's name now. His trailer hit a mine, caught fire. Well, there was an emergency inside the tank. You could press a button and blow it off. He did that, moved on, and he hit the mine. So he said to Sergeant Henderson, abort, come back. So he came back towards us, and just before he got to us, he hit a mine. So we were stuck there. Well, we were there for about 20 minutes. The mortars and shells was raining in.
Where were the Germans? Where were they firing from?
From this village where we were.
Of Freldenhof.
And I mean,
yeah.
Where we were almost through the Siegfried Line.
Right.
It was the actual Siegfried Line. Yeah. We were almost through it. And anyhow, so we were there about 20 minutes. And we had our orders to bail out. So we went to our bailing out drill, as taught in the classroom.
Right. What's the bailing out drill? You better tell me.
Well, as a gunner, I had to take the breech block from the machine gun and the breech block from the 75mm. I had to take that. The wireless operator had to scramble the radio, so he couldn't use that. I think the wireless operator had to bring a Bren gun out, which he did. And the driver had to bring the Bren mags. Anyhow, we did our drill again over the back of the tank in a minefield. You get into your own tank tracks, you know, you're all right. So we run back, all mud, diving down with the mortars and machine guns that were firing. And we got into a bomb crater and set up the machine gun. No magazines, no ammunition.
What had happened to it?
Well, whoever was supposed to board it out, I thought it was a driver, didn't bring it out. So, why, I don't know. Lieutenant Adams said, Locke, go back and get the magazines. So I had to go back and get them.
So where did you have to go back to?
Back to the tank, about 200 yards.
Right.
I got back, climbed up the treads of the trailer, over the engine, and dived in head first. Well, I wasn't going in front. I dived in head first. Got the box of magazines. I said, well, I can't carry this lot. So I shoved them inside me tank suit. And I have one left, magazine left. Now, I don't know why. I threw it out into the sugar beet. I was going to get out, and I heard somebody shout. And upon the road, about 50, 60 yards away, was an American Stuart tank. And the commander shouted out, when I fire, you run. And so he started his machine gun going, and I got up, and I ran back and joined the rest of the crew.
So why did he shout that to you, do you think?
Well, he must have known that I had to come out. He saw me go in.
Yeah.
He must have come out, and he knew there was all these machine guns and that from the Germans coming, like, you know.
Yeah.
I thought, well, if he could keep them at bay, give me a chance.
So he gave you some covering fire.
That's right, yeah. Anyhow, we then went back to the squadron leader's tank, and he told us to return to base where we left in the morning. Told us off for not spreading out enough, being too close. He said you could all get killed, spread out. So we spread out about, I suppose, 10 yards apart. But being it was so wet and walking back, every few yards we had to scrape the mud off our boots, and all up the inside of our legs was all mud, you know, and it got heavier and heavier. So it's round about 1:32 o'clock in the afternoon, we got back, sat on a wall having a smoke, and somebody said, "Oh, look, who's coming?" And it was our second in command. He was there with his steel helmet and respirator at the ready, you know.
What was his name, your second?
Colonel Voigers, I think it was. Voigers. He left out Adam, said, "Stay there and I'll go and meet him." He went to meet him, like, you know, told him what the position was. And he came up. And our orders was to return to the tank. Remember, you're British. Fire to the last round. So we had to trudge all the way back again. Soaking wet. Miserable as hell.
A bit chilling, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Tell you to fire to the last round.
Well, the thing was being, couldn't even traverse the turret because it was all jammed up with a track from the tank where it got blown up, you know.
So they were disabled, really.
Oh, yes, yeah. So, well, we went back again. It was dusk when we got there. And they obviously could see us because they threw a few mortars in at us while we were getting in. So there we were, sat there, cold, wet, miserable. So they said, "Oh, better have a brew." So we brewed up inside the tank, like, you know.
What sort of stove did you use inside the tank?
We had little petrol stoves, you know, primer stoves. We weren't supposed to use them inside the tank, of course, but we had no option. After all, we had 400 gallons of fuel behind us. So we stayed there overnight, and next morning we got light. It was still raining, things were pretty quiet. We got out, started to have a smoke, and in come the mortars again and the heavy machine gun. So obviously we were being observed, like.
Yeah.
So back we dived in the tank again out of the way. And then later on in the day, an American recovery vehicle come up. He decided to take Sergeant Henderson's tank out first. Oh, prior to that, the engineers went through with their mine detectors. No mines. Anyhow, in went the recovery vehicle, and bang, up it went. So then they decided they'd have to prod for the mines, and they were made of wood. Yeah, that's why they weren't being detected. They were wooden one. But they said we were lucky in some respect because the ground was so sodden wet, it took a lot of the explosion. Had it been hard, it would have come up. There would have been a lot more damage done. But all four of us, we all disabled. But no injuries, no loss of life. They eventually got us out and put us on tank transporters and took us back, dumped us on the side of the road, and we were by a cemetery, and in the corner of the cemetery was a hut. And there was a combustion stove in there, so we went up there and took our tank suits off and scraped all the mud off and dried them out a little bit, like, you know. Had a little bit of a meal on the stove while we were about it. And then while we were in there, almost 48 hours, was the longest 48 hours I've ever known. But the next 48 hours was when they repaired the tank and we were ready to go back in again. That was the shortest 48 hours I'd ever known. You know, it seemed so quick that we were ready to go back again.
Yeah. So you were still round Hale in?
Well, we were in Germany. Over. And while we were there, our second day there, our four troop went in. They went into Mersenhausen, and they met tighter tanks dug in with their barrels level with the ground, and they tore them apart. We had a like deaths and injuries there, and all the tanks were knocked out.
So you heard about that at the time, did
yeah,
you?
Yeah, well, you heard it over the radio, like, you know, a particular friend of mine got killed there. That hurt me, you know, that's... Because we were such great friends, and he was a Scouser, and we always having a laugh and a joke, you know. And one of the chaps was very badly burnt, and they took him off to hospital. We didn't see him anymore for a long while.
So that was quite a sort of dramatic news for you, wasn't it?
Yes, and the chap that got badly burnt, he was taken away, but I'll come back to him later on because there's a story attached to him. But from then on, we were moved around with the American 2nd Armored Division. There was one time when...
So you were with the 2nd Army, U.S.?
2nd Armored Division. Of the 9th American Army,
right,
yeah.
Okay.
And we were called in to support the infantry. I can't remember exactly where it was. And we went in. There was only two of us, flamethrowers. And I could hear our Lieutenant Adams getting a bit irated, like. And apparently the infantry behind us, instead of supporting us, they dug in and they weren't coming forward, like, you know. And
where was this exactly, tell me again?
I can't remember exactly the place it was. It was after we'd gone through the sea free line. It was in Germany.
Right.
And we found out after, we were told after, these infantry, they were brought over from America. They landed in Liverpool. And they were trained down to Southampton. And I'm not sure whether they stayed 3 days in Southampton or 3 days in France. But they were brought straight up and put into action. They'd never had a shell fired in anger before. And they went, that was the reason, like, you know, that caused it, like, you know.
Where did you first fire your gun?
My first firing was when we crossed over the German border.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So you had real targets?
Well, yes.
That make it very different to all the practice you'd done?
Yeah, well, the thing was, we had to attack this village. You throw shells into the village. What they were doing, you don't, you see them explode and that was it, like, you know. But, and then we hit this mine, and I couldn't even traverse the turret then, like, you know, so we were blocked. And from then on, we were in and out of the bank very many times, although we were at the front all the time and with the shells and mortars and all that. We were always called in to flame. We were used as a tank firing guns and that, but not actually to flame, like, you know.
Right. So where did you first use the flamethrower? Was that later on?
Oh, yeah, later on. Right, okay. Exactly where, I can't remember. Yeah. There was one time, it was, we had to attack a wood. And they said there was anti-tank gun in there and heavy machine gun. The American infantry wanted support, so we went up. And the officer said to me, like, throw some HE in, like, you know. I threw some HE.
HE?
Yeah, high explosive shell.
Okay.
Into the wood. So I did, and then the wireless operator shouted out, separated case. This was another thing I'd never heard other than the classroom. And this is where a shell blocks in the gun and it separates from the actual case. when all the cordite come out, well, we used to carry a shortened case that you could put in there. So I shouted out for a shortened case, and thank goodness he couldn't get the shortened case in because the cordite had come out and jammed at the mechanism. But the trouble is, when you have a separated case, if the copper ring around the shell is damaged or it's oversized, that jams in, and when the gun fires, the heat behind it explodes the shell in the gun. You know, and that's what I was frightened of. But as I say, we couldn't get the shortened case in. So I started firing at the wood with my machine gun. And then I had one shot, stop, one shot, stop. And I knew what that was. That was a crack in the gas chamber. So instead of returning the piston, it wouldn't return. We went on, and we got within 100 yards of the wood, and the flame gun wouldn't work. So three weapons, and neither of them would work. So our officers shouted out to Sergeant Anderson to take the operation over, that we were returning. We couldn't do anything, we were returning. And that was when I was frightened. We turned back, and when you're back to the enemy, that's the thinnest part of the town. And I kept saying to myself, it'd be quick. If it's coming, it'd be quick. But we did get back. We got back all right. Yeah.
So, I mean, were all these weapons normally very unreliable? Or
the flamethrower was very unreliable. Right. The electronics, mostly. Yeah, that was very... Yeah. But never had any trouble with a machine gun before. No. And I had a new one after and never had any trouble again. Yeah. And never had a separated case again, like, you know.
Jerry Locke, end of reel 3. Jerry Locke, reel 4. So the...